This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Turmeric Liposome Complex, a natural solution to chronic pain. Future Farm's liquid turmeric with liposomes and nanotechnology delivers maximum absorption for effective pain relief. Sourced and manufactured in the United States, this product contains 1,600 milligrams of curcumin and powerful antioxidant properties. This plant-based curcumin is used to possibly reduce inflammation, block proteins that trigger swelling, and intercept inflammatory pathways, significantly decreasing inflammatory responses. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Take advantage of Future Farm's buy two, get one free offer at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can come to us via email. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. And I'm happy to say that we have a full mailbox this week. I'm with Layla Mudin, who's our nutritionist in residence. It's always gratifying that people take up the challenge to send us questions. And we have quite a few in our mailbox, so that should provide us with fodder for our weekly discussion. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
I'm a little shaggy, but I'm awaiting government approval to get a haircut. I'm on the wait list. That may happen sometime in July, but you know, I kind of have a. I'm sporting. You know, I look at my college graduation picture, where uh-huh. I kind of you know, look like a 1970s radical, and I kind of look that way.
It's back in style.
I'm replicating.
Being a radical anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and so I got a big curly mop of hair, and but I did get an outreach from my hair cutter. Who said, we are awaiting approval to begin cutting hair again. And when you come into the salon, you're going to have a mask. We're going to have to socially distance. We'll have to limit the number of people in the salon simultaneously.
Sure.
And oh, by the way, there's a $5 surcharge for all the extra stuff we have to do. I don't know.
I was going to say, make sure to tip them well. You know, they haven't been working all this time.
Oh, I will very. You know, I will very generously because. Oh my goodness! It's like those poor people. I mean,
I can't wait to see my stylist. Honestly,
You know, it's so different. I talk to people in different industries, and some people are thriving. They're doing fine. You know, they're virtually mm-hmm. untouched, and in fact, they're doing better. People who, you know, I've interviewed some people in the nutritional supplement industry, and the sales are through the roof. They can't keep up with demand. And, that's great for them. But I just really feel sorry for the retailers, especially, you know, the large retailers. They may have, you know, the ability to whatever, file for bankruptcy and, or, you know, get some kind of government assistance. But the small retailers, you know, New York City still remains boarded up in the wake of the civil disturbances that were here last week. And mm-hmm. so today is a day where things are opening up officially in New York. But I think there's going to be, you know, with all that brand new plywood that they put up last week, I think some people who put up that plywood are going to say, we need to amortize our investment. We just put up all that plywood last week, even though we're permitted to do business. We're, you know.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't pay to put up all that plywood, that elaborate barricade, you know, for just one week. So maybe they're going to wait another week until the coast is clear. So that's happening. I wanted to just share with you before we get into our questions, Michael Pollan.
Yes.
Michael Pollan is a foodie. He's like a food guy.
Right.
He frequently writes for the New York Times. I believe he's a columnist for the Times, but he also writes elsewhere. And he has a nice article in New York Books, New York Review of Books. Do you read New York Review of Books?
No.
Yes, this is for intellectuals.
Mm.
This is for intellectuals. It's a review of books. But,
okay.
So it's not on my regular reading list. Okay. So, interesting article, The Sickness in Our Food Supply. And I actually referenced that in my newsletter article this week, which is The Lessons of the Pandemic. And what he's saying here is that for our society, the COVID-19 pandemic, and I'm quoting, represents an ebb tide of historic proportions, one that is laying bare vulnerabilities and inequities that in normal times have gone undiscovered. Nowhere is this more evident than in the American food system. A series of shocks has exposed weak links in our food chain that threaten to leave grocery shelves as patchy and unpredictable as those in the former Soviet bloc. The very system that made possible the bounty of the American supermarket, its vaunted efficiency and ability to, quote, pile it high and sell it cheap, suddenly seems questionable, if not misguided. But the problems the novel coronavirus has revealed are not limited to the way we produce and distribute food. They also show up on our plates, since the diet on offer at the end of the industrial food chain is linked to precisely the types of chronic disease that render us more vulnerable to COVID-19. And so he's saying it's really a call to action to improve our food production, to improve food quality, but also to rely more on local food producers. And this is something that we try to do. I'm out on Long Island, as you are. And you're on the North Shore. And
yes.
One of the things
on the North Fork.
The North Fork. And on the North Fork, there are farms where there's local food production. And one of the places where we're getting really high-quality grass-fed and organic meat is a local food production facility there. I won't mention the name.
Yeah.
But it's an example. And, you know, I'll share that with you if you haven't already discovered it. It's more in your neck of the woods than it is in mine, because I'm on the South Fork on weekends. And, you know, it's, you know, close to the water. I like to swim. Water's getting warmer. And I took a nice 20-mile bike ride this weekend. It's, you know, getting to be
lovely
prime exercise season, which is welcome since the gyms are still closed here in New York. The problem with meat production is that a lot of farmers rely on these big factory food processing places. That's sort of a weasel word for a slaughterhouse. And when the slaughterhouses close down due to pandemics, because the workers there work under very, very challenging conditions, and a very high percentage of them tested positive for COVID-19. Many of them were asymptomatic, interestingly, but, you know, some of them were sick. And so these were thought to be hot spots for COVID-19, so they had to close them. And they literally had to slaughter hogs and bury them in ditches because they couldn't process them. And so this is, you know, we're discovering some things about the resilience of our food production in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all for these small farms.
Right.
You know, I like the idea of supporting family farms and
right,
you know, small
the local agriculture. There are several small farms on the North Fork.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably do know who you're talking about. There are several that we go to.
To get produce, of course, there's a lot of produce. There's also a lot of vineyards there.
It's a lot
famous
of vineyards.
For vineyards. But it's also,
right. I mean, and in the 1970s, they were mostly potato farms and other farms, and now they're all vineyards.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, potatoes, the margin on potatoes is a lot less than the margin on wines. So, you know, utilize that land to maximal effect. I mean, preferable to putting meadow mansions on that property. It's nicer to maintain the rural quality of places like that. So anyway, in our newsletter is a reference to that article. I suggest that people go and find it. It's in the New York Review of Books. And if you're already an intellectual, you probably read it cover to cover every week. I don't.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, so, and here we go. And we've started planting. Okay. We started our vegetable patches of various things.
Your victory
besides,
garden, right?
Yeah, yeah. Besides herbs and things, you know, zucchini and lettuces and kale and scallions. I'm a huge fan of scallions.
And there's nothing like fresh stuff
munching
out of the garden. We're much less ambitious. I have an herb garden. You know, there's nothing like getting fresh herbs. You know, like if you're preparing a dish, you just say, oh, let me just go outside and snip some, you know, some oregano.
Snip
some thyme or, and we have all those things going on, some tarragon, some kind of bugs got our basil, so we grow it inside in a window box, inside the kitchen. But, you know, that's something that I think would be nice for people to incorporate. You know, it's also, if you have kids, it's a really nice project, to, you know, have kids involved. It gets them to have more familiarity with the way that food is prepared and grown. It doesn't come in, you know, a cellophane package or a can.
Right. And it doesn't appear that way, the way it is in the grocery store. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, maybe we'll spawn a whole new generation of people who, you know, utilize fresh garden vegetables. That would be nice.
Yeah. Amen to that. Okay.
So let's get to questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com, I'll remind you, is the destination for questions. No, there's no such thing as a dumb question.
We have a question from Ahmed. Thank you for all the invaluable information you provide. It's truly appreciated. Can you provide an intake on our virome and its importance? Mm-hmm. It seems to be eclipsed by the well-researched microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And second, why do people or scientists anthropomorphize viruses? They're inert. They can't do anything on their own.
Okay. Well, let's tackle, you know, this issue of the virome. The virome is possibly as important as the microbiome. The microbiome partakes of the bacteria and perhaps fungi that inhabit our gastrointestinal. You know, there's also, I guess, a fungome, right, which talks about the different fungi, some of which are harmful and some of which are beneficial. And we know that these things have been with us since time immemorial. And, you know,
it's more like a holobiome. We're all walking around like Pigpen from the Peanuts cartoon,
right, with those little lines that came off him that suggested that there was some aroma emanating
Pigpen
from him, right? My hair looks a little like that right now. But so the human virome is the collection of all viruses that are found in or on humans. And that includes, you know, 380 trillion viruses. Trillion.
Wow.
Okay.
Trillion. Uh-huh.
And, so, you know, I guess by saying anthropomorphizing, you know, we think of viruses as the enemy. Some of them are deadly. Some of them are neutral. And some of them may actually have beneficial interactions with us. With our immune systems, and even they may even help to control bacteria. They are what are called bacteriophages, which are certain types of viruses that actually may go after bad bacteria.
Like good soldiers.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the implication of this is that if in anthropomorphizing viruses, or I don't quite know what he means by that, but to anthropomorphize something is to give it a sentient quality, you know, to make it as if it's human-like, that it can think, that it can, you know, attack us viciously, or that it can, you know, imputing human-like motivations to things that are essentially a small hunk of RNA encapsulated in a lipid envelope, you know, which is, you know, morally neutral. Right? You know, and certainly not sentient, but viruses do have a capacity to adapt And it makes it seem like they're smart, you know, that it's natural selection. But by modifying in such a way that they find a niche to afflict us with diseases, it makes it seem like they're, you know, insidious or sinister. I guess that's what he might mean by that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess another consequence of all the social distancing and the sterilizing has to do with the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis posits that we need to be exposed to germs, not just bacteria, but perhaps also viruses, to modify our immune system and program it. And it literally is like, you know, you get a new computer and it's a blank slate. It may come with programs, but then, you know, you may, like when I do a Zoom conference, I have to download Zoom. You know, when mm-hmm. I, you know, want to add Skype, I have to download Skype. I have to put it in, you know, my computer is naive to that program. So I actually need to put that in. And similarly, bacteria and viruses program our immune system to respond. And germ-free animals, animals that are raised in sterile environments, where we kill off their bacteria, have terrible immune systems. So
yeah.
This is the essence of the hygiene hypothesis, which is that in the West, we have less contact with germs. And therefore, you know, thank goodness, you know, we're not dying of some of the scourges of the Middle Ages, you know, the plague and whatnot. And we're getting vaccines to prevent diseases. But it may be that our immune systems are less robust, or it may be even that, you know, we get more allergies or autoimmune diseases because our immune systems aren't properly trained in so-called, you know, third world or primitive societies. They have a much worse toll from infections, but they have less in the way of allergies and autoimmunity. So there's kind of a, you know, we'll have to sort of see, you know, what the legacy of all our cleanliness is going to be. I mean, certainly it might be nice to have less colds and flus, you know, ordinary colds and flus, because we are doing some of the very same things that prevent ordinary colds and flus.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll have less of those nuisance things because we don't, you know, swap, you know, airborne particles as readily anymore.
Mm.
I guess that's what he means by anthropomorphizing. I think I'm trying to read into that comment a little bit, but it's a thoughtful comment anyway.
Yeah. So, and Robin is asking actually a similar question with regard to coronavirus. Can a person live without symptoms or not very serious symptoms for life with this virus? If their immune system is never triggered, then why could the virus ever be cleared?
Mm-hmm.
Is this kind of like the herpes virus?
Okay, it's an interesting question. And the answer is that we do know that there are asymptomatic carriers of SARS-CoV-2, which is the coronavirus that causes COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And, the asymptomatic carriers, it was thought, could be spreaders. And that was a very, very scary prospect is, you know, to control a pandemic, you need to identify the people who are sick and then segregate them, you know, quarantine them, take them out of circulation.
Mm-hmm.
But if a person could be contagious and not even know that they're contagious and be asymptomatic, the spread could be much more rampant.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would argue for universal testing, you know, like just test everybody, you know, just to make sure that you feel fine, but you might have it. You might be a spreader. That was what was coming up in the first couple of months with this. And now WHO, World Health Organization, which, by the way, has not earned a reputation for trustworthiness and consistency, has now said, now it's common for people. Everybody acknowledges that it's common for people to be asymptomatic and have it. That's been well demonstrated. But they say those people aren't that contagious. Why aren't they that contagious? Because they don't secrete a lot of particles. They're not sneezing and coughing and circulating.
Right.
Now, you know, if you have someone who is positive and asymptomatic and you get up close and personal, you know, maybe, you know, no kissing on the mouth, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
you know, you take certain precautions. But, okay, so what she's saying is, could it be a chronic virus? Could it, well, there are certain viruses like the herpes virus, chickenpox, which occur, but then they remain in the body.
Right.
And these are generally of the herpes virus family, chickenpox, Epstein-Barr virus. There are certain types of viruses which are chronic. Same thing with hepatitis. You know, hepatitis, you know, can be chronic. This virus does not appear to be chronic. And it appears that even the people who are asymptomatic develop within a couple of weeks acquired immunity. And that acquired immunity nicely extinguishes the virus. They they turn negative, and the virus can no longer be detected. So, I mean, look, when at first, when we didn't know anything about this virus, we thought, hey, it could be chronic. I mean, look, HIV, that's a perfect example of a chronic virus.
Yeah.
And, you know, but is this a chronic virus? It does not appear to be the case. That this, I mean, other viruses, I mean, Zika, for example, there was a concern that with Zika, that it would stay in the body for a long time. It was even detected in semen of apparently recovered Zika virus sufferers for weeks and months afterwards. So, you know, concern about potentially sexual transmission. You know, so, but this does not appear to be, I mean, this, I think one of the good news stories about coronavirus, you know, it's like, I put up an article on social media, like things to be thankful for about the coronavirus, the things that it doesn't do. Well, it doesn't kill people as relentlessly as some things like smallpox or the Spanish flu. It doesn't appear to be chronic like herpes and come back cyclically. It doesn't kill young people. It can affect young people and make them very sick, but that's the really the exception rather than the rule. Also that it may attenuate, it may be weakening. You know what intrigues me about this is that we had a real breakout week. There'll be the past couple of weeks. So, for example, they had this big gathering in Ozark. I'm watching the Netflix series Ozark. You know, and it's a big recreational area.
That's a great series.
Yeah, I love it.
That was Memorial Day weekend.
Oh yeah,
and everybody, the first unofficial weekend of summer.
And so all these kids came down to it's a recreational area in the Ozarks. It's a big artificial lake. And, you know, they went around on their jet skis and on their boats, and they had parties at bars and stuff like that. And from what I'm reading, that did not cause a second wave big time. Then we had the experiment, you know, let's look at it neutrally from the standpoint of, you know, regardless of your political views, we had a lot of people who were not practicing social distancing. Yes, they were wearing masks, okay, but they were also close together, and some weren't wearing masks. And some, you know, may have been in close gatherings where they were in rooms where maybe they were planning their strategy for, you know, this is how we're going to march. This is how we're going to protest. And that was way ahead of the permitted phase one or phase two in some of the states like New York where this is happening.
Yes.
And it's now been about 10 days since then.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people said, oh, wait till you see. Oh, this is a disaster because all these people, they're violating the social distancing and we're going to see a major surge. And they it was recommended by Mayor de Blasio that they all be tested. Anybody who went outside in a demonstration, got close, they should all be tested. Well, they didn't. I mean, maybe some did, but I bet the vast majority didn't. But they're not coming down sick. We're not seeing this. So that's kind of a good thing about this virus.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree.
So, you know, things to be thankful for. It could have been worse. Not to minimize the devastation. 100,000 plus dead is no joke. It's also a significant majority of them were vulnerable and sick. There were some outliers, some people who were ostensibly healthy who got sick and died from it.
Sure.
But, you know, mostly it was sort of attacking people who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And not to minimize the misery of, you know, people who were sick were very sick and, debilitating and uncomfortable. And there may have been an aftermath for some of the people who were sick, you know, that they just feel tired and achy and some
the
have
fatigue isn't letting
likes.
Up.
Yeah.
Or,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We are seeing some of that. So that this is, you know, this is not inconsequential. It's very serious,
mm-hmm.
but, it's relenting. It seems to be remitting and relenting. So that's good.
Yeah.
So, on that note, let's pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. Give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Oh, my son suffers from anxiety. I've tried everything. Help.
Okay, we'll tackle that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back with more.